crack your joke.
All right. So for the joke of the day, what's the difference between a priest and Woody from Toy Story?
Oh, man. I'm glad we don't have any kids listen to this.
Why not now?
Woody goes limp when a child walks in the room. Welcome to Racing Home Podcast. You're joined by your hosts, Nick Igater, and myself, Fez Barber. And today we have a guest, Carl Tott, fellow S2K enthusiast, also Global Time Attack champion, and on-grid champion. I don't know how many championships he's going. All of them. You have a bunch of trophies, but I don't see first place, Carl. What happened?
I see a lot of twos.
Yeah, I see a lot of twos. Where's the first place?
I think they're out of view, maybe. Yeah, here's one.
There you go. There you go. Okay. So for today's podcast, Grid Life, you got third place too, right? Right. There you go.
Yep.
For reference, people, Carl drove his stock Cayman GT4 all the way from Seattle to Laguna Seca, got third place in Street GT, and then drove it back home. That's very rare to see, very rare to happen in a competition like Grid Life. So that kind of put in perspective how we're spending with so much money in our cars to get like fourth place, and we should have just bought a GT4.
Yeah, because those are obviously the cost-effective solution, right?
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. But like one of them you could just buy from the dealership. The other one you're crying underneath your car getting bloody knuckles. So
And you got to tow it everywhere. So like the amount of money you're spending in gas, getting a tow truck and everything. Just buy a GT4, drive it there, and drive it home. And you're done.
True. But that's not his only car. Carl also has a S2000 that he competes at a pretty high level. Getting caged right now, right?
Yes, sir. It's in Minnesota right now with Arts and Fab. So same guy that built the cages for Andy and ASM cars is building a cage for me.
That's pretty awesome. So what organizations do you want to go and compete in once it's caged?
So there's a local place here that's called like Conference for short. It's like a 5-letter acronym with a bunch of S's and C's that I'm not going to remember. But they run a bunch of like events in Pacific Northwest. So hoping to run with them, maybe SCCA, and then hoping to show up for GLTC in Laguna. But that's a little bit of a long shot right now, just because I think there's going to be some shakedown. So
so a little bit background. Cool. When did you buy this SDK and the build history of it? Like, what have you done to it?
Yeah, so I got this S2000, I guess, is it really coming up on 5 years? Yeah, I got it in 2019. I had got it from a guy that loved it. He owned it. It was stolen and totaled. And then he turned it into a race car because it was totally screwed up when he got it back from being stolen. He tracked it for years. Bought it for like $8,500. It was an AP1 with... So, I mean, crazy, because I feel like now the prices have skyrocketed, but it was like track-prepped car, you know, not super pretty looking, but it went. So I basically tracked it for like a couple of years, like in a form. And then over time, it's just been slowly developing, getting like a little bit crazier. And now it is like a big aero boosted S2000 that I guess, you know, plays with like McLaren's and GT3, so that's fun.
Nice.
That's pretty cool.
What you doing, Nick?
Oh, for the for anyone who actually watches the video, I was just pulling up a photo of Carl's S2000. So
yeah,
you can see it on
the
screen.
Zebulon Aero.
Zebulon Aero, hard shell. Dude, it looks really good. Mm-hmm. Are you going to do any livery changes for this year?
Probably not, except that I will like try to finish all the little bits. I think I got a new hardtop actually just with the cage, so I'll have to get that wrapped. And then the lip on the livery was not installed, so it doesn't look quite as good as it should, just because I had to optimize for like the aero rather than how pretty it looked. So I went with my old lip and that was not wrapped.
I gotcha. Well, cool. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to like tell everyone is like for how long we've known each other. So we've known each other since what, 2012-ish? 2012, yeah. 2013. Because at least by the time that I got to know you, I was working at Costco at the time at UT Dallas. You were also going to UT Dallas. So about that time frame, that was 2012, 2013. So we've known each other now for About 12 years, call it. That's pretty crazy. Yeah. A dozen years. And at the time, I love telling this story. You had this black BMW E30 with a license plate that said Seth. And like among Frisco, it was like Robbie and I, we would drive around and like we always saw the car over at Raising Cane's. And every so often we'd be driving around El Dorado, Dallas North Tollway. If you're from Dallas, you know those roads.
But this is when Dallas didn't have as many people, so you could spot people.
You could spot people. You could do some highway runs, and you could be a hooligan, basically. Mm-hmm. And be a hooligan Seth, is that what we called it, was, because I don't know what time you'd get off shift, but you would hop in the car, and we would hear you before we saw you, like just flying down the tollway back towards Carrollton. And then there was like one night where we were in our cars, trying to like effectively chase you down, but holy fuck, man, you would fly down onto the access road and get going. We wouldn't do this now, but it was clutch dropping at nearly every stoplight drag racing. It was legally, sure, not legally, but in any case, it's long enough ago. Statute of limitations are behind us. Yeah, we thought your name was Seth, and then how did you and Robbie meet? I guess y'all met at UT Dallas, and it's like, because I got a text message from Robbie. And he said, Nick, I met Seth. His name is not Seth. His name is Carl. It's like, oh, okay. But like because of that car and like through that connection, oh, and then the backwards connection behind that was the very first time you and I met was going go-karting at Dallas Karting Complex. And basically Rob just threw you in the back of my Subaru WRX. And ever since then we've been friends.
When was the go-karting thing?
Doesn't matter, you weren't there.
Because I remember we went go-karting as well when I started our UTD in 2014, and that's where I met you guys.
The Dallas Karting Complex?
Yeah.
What are the chances? What
car did you have at the time? That was like 2 years later.
That was 2 years because I started UTD in 2014.
That makes sense. Yeah, because we were already at UT Dallas and doing some car shit. That's funny that we also met through Dallas Karting Complex, you're right.
I think we met through the driver's club first, and then I was kind of like just randomly invited to go karting with you guys. I remember I had my mom's Acura TL, and you had your WRX, and we did like a little pull on George Bush, and it was like neck and neck.
Yeah, I was like, fuck, my WRX is over here tuned and can't beat a mom car.
Yeah, it was a good time.
That's too funny. But I don't know. Were there any other background stories you want to tell?
I don't know. I think I'll just like finish that story, which I thought was hysterical because Ravi, like I had met Ravi through UT Dallas, and then we, like you said, went to DKC. But I just remember so clearly, like I had never met like anyone, I think besides like Chase at the time. And we all meet up, and he's just like, oh, we don't have enough seats. Here, get in the back of this car. And like, you didn't even get out of the car, I think, when I met you. I literally just got in the back of your car and was like, I hope I'm not going to die.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't get out or like shake your hand or anything. You just like hopped in, and Daniel was with me in the passenger seat. And we're just like, sup. All right, head to Dallas Karting Complex, and just started talking.
Yeah, that was hysterical. That's when I learned that you bought parts for your WRX before you even owned the car, which I thought was hysterical. And I was like, I'm going to like this guy.
Yeah, that 100% was true. Because at the time that I was shopping around for the WRX, I had a Mazda 3 sedan. And I only bought that Mazda 3 sedan so I can learn how to drive stick, because my family never had one. And at the time, none of my friends had one that I could beat on, basically, and like learn to drive. So I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna tease myself, and the only way to do that is to buy a car that I don't really care about. So I bought a Mazda 3, drove it for like 8 months, and then sold it. But in any case, like while I was shopping around for WRXs, I was like, I'm dead set on it, I'm gonna buy it, buy one, let me go ahead and buy some car parts before I even fucking buy the car. I think I bought the cob exhaust, bought the hangers. That was like the main things that I immediately recall buying before buying the car. Yeah, and I still have Cobb. Dude, you got to hear the focus now. With Catalyst, it is much louder. I think you can actually finally hear it on videos.
You can. It's pretty loud.
It's kind of wild how much, like, downpipes and headers make a difference. Like, My E46 that I have has only headers and a stock exhaust otherwise, which has like two, like a resonator and a large muffler, and it's still so loud for just like a street car, even though the only thing that's done is just headers.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And then the turbo car, you just hear so much more of the turbo spool. And now that I'm E85, you just smell it so much more too. Smelling gas, gasoline is not very good, but smelling E85, even Carol was like, all right, I can get behind this.
I don't like smelling any of it.
Really? You don't like smelling? Well, not that I'm sniffing it. I'm not sitting behind the exhaust smelling it, but like, it doesn't reek. It's not like diesel or gasoline.
I remember when I was I had just moved to Chicago, and I was like at the area where they do the skyline. You can see the skyline in the back, and I parked my car on the sidewalk to take some photos, and cops drove by, and she was like literally got out of the car to look at my car and just went like this. Sorry, I hit my mic. Or like was like waving her hand in front of her nose, like, yeah. And like it was smelling really bad. And I was like, well, yep, it's catless with E85, and I just didn't get a ticket. So got pretty lucky there, but
yep.
Not a huge fan of just the smell of gasoline, I guess. Or fumes.
Yeah.
Smell of gasoline's okay.
Yeah. The other downside with your car is because of how loud the header is and the titanium exhaust, it's quite quite loud. At least with my car, I still have the exhaust flap. So I can actually make it quieter, which is nice. So you're actually coming down, by the way, Fez, for the 13th Harrisville Raceway.
Trying to. So there is a Harrisville event for the audience. There's a private event that Nick is going to. I got invited out by Nick as well. So I'm going to try to go there, but need to get some stuff done on the car beforehand, like installing the harnesses and then lowering the front end just a little bit and getting the car aligned before going back out there. I'm not sure if I need to get the car aligned after lowering it. I mean, it's hair.
You should definitely double check.
It's going to get messed up, but I don't know if it's going to get messed up enough for me to care for a shakedown.
First shake. I mean, we could also align it at the shakedown. If you go out and say something doesn't feel right, and that might be something to go and take a look at. I'll have my tow plates with me, so we can adjust it at the track.
Yeah, it's more of a camber that I'm worried about than tow, because like when you lower it, McPherson's right, it's gonna like go in more.
Yeah, gotta make sure it all aligns correctly. Yeah. I think something that's actually really cool, at least for like this podcast and the topic of like where we want to go with this, is talking about like driver improvement. Mm-hmm. And among the three of us, Carl, you are very fortunate in having a father that basically does racing before you were even born. So you must have got, or like, did you actually get like a lot of your driving skills from him? Or like, how did that all start?
To an extent. I mean, so my dad was very into cars. So maybe like slight backstory. My dad got into cars when he was like in high school, but more college. He had like an old Honda. And when I say old Honda, I mean like a first generation Honda Civic. And he wrenched on that some. And then he quickly learned that instead of like working a minimum wage job, he could make more money like fixing Hondas on the weekend. So he would do like engine swaps, like clutch jobs, like CV jobs. Cause like, I guess like it's weird for us to think about, but I guess back then, like an engine might last 100,000 miles and people would just be like, okay, I'll replace the engine on this car. And it was like not that uncommon. So he got super into cars, I think, through that process. At one point had the license plate Mr. Honda, which is pretty funny. I had been basically at the, like, he got into tracking maybe in the very early 90s. And from the time I can remember, like when I was two, I was around the racetrack. So it was,
that's pretty cool.
Kind of have that. My dad was never truly racing though. So he made it to be an instructor pretty soon with like BMW Club. That's who he ended up ultimately like tracking a bunch with, ironically up here in Pacific Northwest where I am now. So he got me on track, I think, by the time I was like 15. So I was like doing stuff at like Apex Driving Academy, which is kind of funny because that still exists under new ownership, but same.
Under new ownership, same. And it seems like they're doing some pretty cool shit now too. I really want.
So your dad owned Apex Academy, or did he run it, or like what was the deal with that?
Instructing for it.
So he started out instructing, then he became lead instructor. So he'd do like the novice classroom in the morning, right? In addition to like the just regular instructing. And then they liked him a lot. So at the time it was owned by John and Keith, and they brought him on as another partial owner. So he owned like a small stake.
Fuck.
And then I think after Keith passed away, he owned like a slightly larger stake. And then obviously you guys know, I think it was sold to Cody, right? I don't know how many years ago that was now, but yeah, so he was an owner in it for a little bit.
That must have been before your father moved to Singapore for a little bit, right?
Yeah, I think he actually owned it for a while, even in Singapore. I don't think they sold it.
That is pretty dope. So he never did racing, but he did a lot of HPDE, like driver education on track.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting, like, is Time Attack was not super popular, I feel like it is now. Like, I mean, yeah. NASA is around, but other than, like, if you weren't racing with, like, NASA or, like, SCCA time trials, right? Like, it's now where I feel like every track day I go to has, like, some kind of Time Attack of it.
Yeah, at least it seems like that over in the Pacific, but over here in Texas, it's really just Apex, NASA. I think those are the only two. SCCA. Yeah.
That's basically all of it. I mean, so that's yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of, it's the same thing as Pacific Northwest, right? Pacific Northwest has NASA, SCCA, and OnGrid, right?
Yeah, they have like a few other like smaller people that will come out and throw like events with like a Time Attack twist to them that run like maybe two events a year in like the area.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
And then, like, what Ravi does, they're Speed SF, and they do Time Attack. And that was, like, my very, very first sense of getting into Time Attack was with them when I drove out to California.
Mm-hmm.
I forget exactly how they classed it, but basically, you just, like, put in your vehicle information, and then it would negate you points, I think. And so it was kind of like a pack system, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's... interesting, because I think the NASA rulebook, like a long time ago, back when it was like TTB, TTC, whatever, used to be like that, where you'd have a chassis with like a starting like points, and then you could add a new pod. And then they do like the power to weight thing, right, with like some modifiers. And then it's funny because now you see like people being like, oh, I can't get, like, not everyone wants to get their car dynoed, so go back the other way.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, there's a lot of different flavors depending on a lot of different flavors of Time Attack depending on what part of the country you're in. So
for sure. But yeah, so as kind of Nick mentioned, today's topic, we want to discuss like how to improve yourself as a driver. Everyone says, you know, seat time. I don't think seat time alone is going to get you where you need to be. So wanted to kind of bring you on, Carl, with your vast experience of since you've been driving since like what, 15, you said. Wanted to bring you on and just have that discussion with you. Before we get into that, what was your first car that you did HPDE with? And then what got you into competitive driving, and what car did you do competitive driving with?
So first car I did track stuff with was that E30 Ceph. So that was just like the basic E30, you know, with like a rebuilt motor and later a cam in it, but not very fast. And then I don't think I actually did... I wanted to do competitive driving as soon as I could, but I just couldn't really afford it back then. Like, it just wasn't viable. So I started in the I started in the GTI, actually. There was an event out in Oregon, and they did Time Attack. So I used to have a Mark 7 GTI, and that was the first car that I did Time Attack in.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were actually doing Time Attack with that car. I thought it was just all HPDE stuff.
Yeah, there was an event. It was pretty cool. It was at Oregon Raceway Park, which is in the middle of nowhere, but amazing track, crazy elevation. And they did a Time Attack series, like super basic, like very limited classes, maybe like somewhere between like 20, 30 competitors total. Mm-hmm. But that was the first time I did Time Attack. And it ended up being an awesome battle because there was like this K-swapped EG versus this like Mark 7 GTI. So two very, very different cars. But it was incredibly close. Like, we were within a few tenths of each other.
I remember that. I remember seeing that. I think it was a EG, right? Or EK. Or, yeah, EK or EG.
I think it was an EG. It was an EG, I think. I like that maroon purple one. It was such an awesome build. It was such a beautiful car.
That's pretty cool.
And out of curiosity, Nick, when did you start driving on track, and when was your first time attack or competitive event?
For me, first time on track was like the lead follow session at Eagles Cane Raceway back in 2013 when I had that red 2012 Ford Focus. So not at all an HPD day, like, I don't know, maybe touch 100 miles per hour because of the lead follow session, but that's where the bug started. But then actual first competition style being on track was at Speed SF at Button Willow in the Focus RS in 2019.
Nice. So your first competitive event was with the RS.
No, I'm sorry. That's not Button. It wasn't Button Willow. It was Thunderhill. And I fucking love Thunderhill. I can't wait to go back. But Thunderhill, that was my first time. Speed SF.
Yeah, Thunderhill's on my bucket list too.
It's such a good track. If there's an opportunity for us to go and do Sonoma and Thunderhill back to back, and maybe Bunwillow, I would be all in. That'd be a really cool set. You've already done Laguna, so you don't have to do that again. But Sonoma, still have yet to do that, and I really want to.
Yeah, Sonoma and Thunderhill are on my to-do list, for sure.
Your luck's going to Thunderhill.
What'd you say?
When was your first track day?
So my first track day was 2017 with the FRS. I was on like Pilot Super Sports and whatnot, like still college driven. Good times. I did the 3.1 MSR Crescent track. And then my first competitive event was my third ever track day. I don't know how they allowed me to just be, hey, yeah, you want to do time trials? Go for it. I went off every session and just, So that was kind of a wake up call of, okay, maybe I'm not ready for time trials. You know, I'm not anywhere near competitive and whatnot. And then I moved out of the state, did some HBD here and there again. And then my actual first official competitive event was Autobahn with GridLife in 2021.
Wow.
Yeah.
What made you feel like you were ready to get into time trials / time attack?
So this was a conversation that I had with DJ Alessandrini. He was my driver coach at Mid-Ohio when I went there for HBT. And I was like, he asked me like what my goals were, right? And I was like, yeah, I want to do time attack. I want to compete in grid life eventually. And he was doing a GLTC at the time. And he was like, well, what's stopping you? And I was like, well, I don't know if I'm ready. And he's like, well, just fucking do it. I don't know. There's nothing really stopping you from it. He's like, yeah, I think he did. He said he did sim for a while, and then he just started to do GLTC, and it was fine. So I was like, you know what? Let's do it. So the following year, I signed up for Autobahn with GridLife, and I asked him to co-drive with me to get me comfortable enough to kind of do it, see if it in the somewhat top five or whatever. And then he showed me like the rain line there as well for a little bit. And we were pretty competitive. I was like top three for the first half of the day. And then it started drying out. In the wet, I was fast. But once it started drying out, I got like top fifth or something like that. In a relatively, you know, stock-ish FRS, which was pretty cool. That's what the bug kind of bit me. And I was like, you know what, let's go ham into this. Club TR is the way to go. And here we are.
Yeah, how little we've been tracking, actually. When I said, like, Thunderhill in 2019, I was like, oh, shit, that's only been 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, for me, tracking I didn't really heavily start tracking until 2021. Before that, I was doing, like, one or two HBDE events a year or something like that, which was, you know, whatever. But after that, it's now, like, 20 days a year.
Yeah. It's funny, like in 21, that's when I really started getting into seriously with time attack and to grid life, because that was the same year that the grid life went to NOLA, which you were supposed to go to, and that's why I signed up
every
and
time
went out there.
Every time you bring that up,
dude, because it was like 2 months of planning or something like that, and like getting the car ready, booking the U-Haul, and then showed up, and Fez is like, nah, man, I don't know.
I told you like a month before, I was like, hey, man, I can't do it.
Yeah, but it sounds more dramatic when I talk about it.
Yeah.
And it still worked out. And like what got me is like going out there for HPDE and then looking at my, I mean, it was using my cell phone to track what I was doing in lap times, but mm-hmm. it was still good enough to see where I was within a second, realistically. Mm-hmm. And then looking at my times, I was like, if I had my car in, I think it was street class, I would have been mid-pack, if maybe a little bit better. So I was like, well, shit, what am I doing wasting my time in HPDE if I would actually be like, what I think, something competitive, like mid-pack, like at least better than Williams in F1 mm-hmm. for grid life terms. And been nonstop ever since then. So with that great idea, that's when I signed up for Super Lap Battle and got my ass handed over to me. But
that was a hysterical event. I'll just say, in retrospect, I felt like Nick was completely overwhelmed at that event. Like, he got to the Super point where he didn't want to... He was like, nah, good. I'm like, bro, you're literally at Coda and you don't want to drive? Like, what is happening?
I did not know that.
It was the brakes that, like, really kind of, like, got in the back of my mind, like, coming down the back straight and, like, having the pedal hit the floor. I was like, let's get a bit more experience out of this one. And
while the other Focus RS driver was Jamie. And his car was basically falling apart and bolts were coming off of it, but he was still driving. Literally
bolts. Yeah, I remember you and I were underneath his car getting his suspension bolted back together. Like, bro, who are you going to and putting this together? You didn't bolt check or eyeball or put torque markings on this?
Someone didn't torque his camber plate, like, bolts, and literally, like, it only had, like, 3 bolts in it because they couldn't physically come out right because they're, like, underneath the strut tower. Yep. And we're like,
Yeah, that was pretty sketchy. I think we got those tightened down. We got every bolt that we discovered was loose, we tightened it back down. Yeah. Or I remember, like, salvaging bolts from something to go and get his car back on track safely. And yeah, he ended up doing a 232 at Coda. I did 235. I'll honestly say, I think if I were to go out there now as the car sits, I think I could break 230s.
I think so too. I think my car can do two sub 230 there.
Yeah, I think so.
Tires, I think, because GLTC is doing 229, and that's usually my benchmark, 229, 228. So if GLTC can do 228, then I should be able to do at least 229s.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, my car typically, well, you and I are basically doing lap times are within half a second of each other at any event we end up going to.
You should be a lot faster now because there's a lot of long straights.
A long straight, yeah.
More power.
Yep. Yeah, so, I think that'd be where most of my time is gained is from the power.
For sure. So in y'all's perspective, as someone new coming into the sport, when should they start looking at converting or moving from HPDE to time trials or time attack?
I feel like that just comes down to safety, right? Like, more than speed. Mm-hmm. I think it's really more about, like, if you are a predictable, aware driver, like, speed isn't that important to, like, whether or not you compete, in my honest opinion, but at least know what you're doing. I feel like there's a lot of people, I don't know how it is, it sounds like Texas has fewer events, but I've definitely been at time attack events here where there's a person in time trials that you were like, what are you doing? Like, you just spun on the outlap. Like, please do better.
Yeah. I feel like I would honestly say that I think you should at least be in advanced session of HPDE. Like, you should be very, very comfortable with flags, recognizing colors like it's second nature, knowing where flag stands are because you look at them in your outlap. Just, like, all the basics that you need to know to get yourself into an advanced session. And really the critical thing is open passing. Like, being comfortable being the one that's getting passed and being comfortable doing the passing, both situations. I think that's, like, basic number 101, that you need to be an advanced HPD driver before you consider getting into time attack. But that's my 2 cents, because there's not too much more that needs to be learned in time attack. The difference between advanced HPD and time attack, in my opinion, is that you have a transponder attached to the front of your car.
Agreed. Yeah, I think I'm with you guys on that too. I think it's, don't do what I did, sign up for a time trials or third ever event. Being comfortable with the flags, you said safety comes is first. So once you're comfortable with overtakes and also not just overtakes in the straightaways, but also in the corners. Like, if you feel comfortable to give a point by within, in the middle of the corner and get someone around you if needed, do that and be predictable. There's been a couple times where GridLife, there was a Miata that was at the back of the pack. I was overlapping at the time. And she had no idea. Like, she was taking some weird lines where it looked like she was giving me room to go, because you don't need point buys at Diamond Tag. You can go. But it looked like she was giving me room to go, and then she just turned in right immediately after. So I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to back off. I don't know what's
wait to look at lane, get some breathing room.
Yeah. Or go around the straights or something, because I don't trust her in the corners. Like, that shouldn't be you at Time Attack.
I think, like, that comes down to, like, the maybe predictability element that I, like, brought up. And, like, the other part maybe to mention is, like, I think if you enter Time Attack too early, you're really prone to pick up bad habits, right? Because you see so many people show up, and they're just like, I want to go as fast as possible. And to them, going fast means pushing harder, not driving better. And those are two kind of different things, right? And if you're going to be in the mindset,
to go up twice at Laguna in front of a GT4.
I wouldn't know.
I'm recalling when I was in front of you, Carl, and I went off on turn 3 and turn 4. But
that was interesting.
I thought RS stands for Rally Sport. I'm sorry.
Didn't you go off in front of Eddie too?
Yeah, that was turn 4. Those were my three of the 4 times I went off at Laguna.
There's like 5 sessions, dude. So you went off 3 out of the 5 sessions? Or 6 sessions?
Well,
2 of them were on the same lap.
Oh.
Right in front of the car.
Should you be in Time Attack? Like, are you safe enough to drive?
Hasn't hit a wall yet.
I mean, to be fair, I also spun out. What'd you say, Carl?
I said, oh, that's the standard, whether or not you've hit a wall.
I feel like once you hit the wall, you kind of pass the barrier. Now you can do Time Attack. Because now you're comfortable, right? Yeah, that's how it goes. So put your car in the wall and then to sign up for time trials. There you go.
Perfect. In my defense, what I should say, when I went off, it was only 2 off.
That doesn't count.
Except for turn 5. Dude, that turn 5 of Laguna, it was actually on a cooldown lap, and I just, like, I was thinking about, like, the lap, and I forgot to slow down more than I, like, I was going faster for the corner than I should have been. So I just went 4.
That's
off
what
there.
Happened to me when I went off at Harris Hill and Canoes Integra, because I was in a cooldown, and I was just going faster than I thought I was, and then it was wet, so I just, and I hit the brakes, nothing happened. Yeah, so that's how I went off. It happens, dude, it happens. It's all good.
Yeah, I'm when my wife is in the car with him.
Dude, I splashed her with mud. And she was like, she was screaming at me in the car. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. I'm like literally flooring it in the mud so I don't get stuck. Yep. And yeah, she's getting splashed with mud on the inside.
She didn't have, her visor was up. It wasn't down. So like the mud was coming into her eye at the same time. Windows down.
Good times.
Carl, you should come down to Texas. It's always an event when you track with us, apparently.
Yeah, I'll be there in like maybe next month, actually, on that note.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, dude, we should plan something.
Let us know what weekend. We'll plan something out if you got time.
Yeah, I'm going because a buddy of mine is graduating. So go for his graduation.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
So next question. All right, go ahead, Carl.
I was going to say, Fez, you said something interesting earlier, which is like seat time alone is like not enough. I'm curious what you were thinking when you said that.
Ooh, I'm glad you brought this up, Carl.
Okay, so people always say seat time. I was going to get to that eventually. But yeah, so people always say like seat time is king, right? Which I do admit, seat time is good. But if you're not looking at your data, and if you're not trying to figure out ways to go fast, because a lot of people that keep doing seat time, and they're just driving the same way over and over and over and over again. They're not looking for that 10-10th. They're not looking for that extra half a second throughout the lap or wherever it might be. You're not comparing data with other people. You're going to be stuck in the same way of driving forever. Because once you hit a barrier of that, like, okay, I'm hitting my marks, driving this way, but like maybe I could break half a second later. They're not looking at that. They're just driving the same way for years. I don't know how long. So I think that's where... seat time alone isn't going to get you to be the top 5, top 10 driver in the country or in your class or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with that. I would say data specifically is like a tool to get better. Mm-hmm. Just like time is a tool to get better. And like you need a combination of all of these things potentially in conjunction, right? To like get better and get better faster. I think like there's no silver bullet, right? For going fast. Like you can't just drive, you can't just look at the data all day, you can't like get on the simulator all day and like hope to just jump in the car and be, you know, a god because, you know, you're rank one or whatever. But like all these things add up in some way.
Yeah. But I would also say it's kind of like there's like four things it takes to be an expert in any kind of field. It's like you have to be in the right environment, you have to do it repetitive, and you have to have timely feedback. And forget the fourth one, something about like patience or deliberate practice. Yeah, deliberate practice, that's what it was. So basically what I'm getting at is like the seat time portion is being in the right environment. Cool. You're sitting in the car, you're on track, that's great. Make sure you're doing it a lot and not just doing it once a year or once every 2 years. Like effectively you gotta go out as much as you can, and in the months or weekends where you can't, use sim rig for practice if you have one, or just keep using the muscle memory basically. And most critically is that when things do go wrong, have a tool. I'm gonna sound like a hypocrite because I don't have a tool technically, I don't have an aim, but ideally have a tool that like gives you data back to see where you're losing time, and with deliberate practice, making sure that you're taking that knowledge from that tool and like actually applying corrections. Otherwise, yeah, you're just practicing bad habits. Yeah. So you got to see where your gaps are and work on those gaps immediately, often, repeatedly.
Yeah, that's what I said too, right? Like seat time alone isn't going to get you where you need to go.
Correct.
It's a combination of a bunch of things.
Yeah, and that's just like, if you're playing basketball, like that's just shooting hoops at your neighborhood basketball court with no one, no coach, no one to correct you. I mean, sure, you might be hitting three-pointers every so often, but if you don't have anyone standing on the sidelines helping you out to improve, then like you're not going to be Kobe. So it's practicing, but it's practicing with the right tools around you and right feedback.
And the right people, too. And that's why I kind of said this before in a previous podcast too, where I'm grateful that I got to compete in Grid Life early on in my time at Tekker, because it made my skill level and driver I became a better driver faster than I would have done otherwise.
Yeah.
If I was competing in NASA or SCCA, the progression would have been a lot slower. But because I was at Grid Life, I was being pushed not only by myself, but also by a lot of the other good drivers that were competing with me. Like if the guy in the similar car can go 3 seconds faster than me, I want to know how. Right? Like I want people to be faster than me so I can figure out and push myself to reach that point too. And that's through data, talking to them, being around them, sharing data with them, sharing setups with them, or whatever it might be. I think that's really, really, environment is, I think, more important than any other aspect. Environment and patience are the two things where I would say it is the most important out of the four.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, because you see it a lot where, I feel like, you know, at least when I started, I put like instructors on a pedestal, but there is such a huge spectrum of instructors, right? And there are people that, you know, you had like DJ, who I think from what I know of him seems like a very competent driver, right? You know, he taught you and like Tomo and stuff, like guys like that are just on a different level. But like, there's people that you can literally learn nothing from at the same time. And like, not to rag on the guy, but like, when I went and moved to Utah, I ran with NASA, and they're like, oh, we're not going to honor your previous experience and put me back in like HPD1 with an instructor. And like my instructor at a speed 3, that was track prep. I had a stock GTI, and on session 2, I was running faster times than my instructor who competed in time attack. So it's kind of like, okay, like how much can I really learn from you if like this is where you're at and this is where I'm at?
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. That's another thing, man. I've had some shit instructors and I've had some really good instructors.
Yep.
Not every instructor is gonna give you what you need. There's been instructors where like I had some instructor that sat with me at NCM because they didn't honor my experience before too. Same thing that happened to you. And he was there for me for a check ride, and he didn't have anything to say. I think he was just making up shit to say to make me feel like he was doing something. And I was like, well, dude, I'm already doing it. I don't know what to tell you. And then, yeah, he just eventually just gave me a check ride and was on his way. So I think having competent instructors doing some research on your instructors, who they are, does matter too.
That does, yeah, absolutely.
Especially if you're like trying to push, like, you know, to be fast, I would say, right? Like, I think for people who are just learning, you know, like mm-hmm. just the, I don't know who the audience is, right? But people who are beginners, like,
oh, it's just think, my mother.
Oh, I'm an idiot, you know? So, but definitely, like, once you want to be competitive, like, the scrutiny on who's teaching you matters so much.
Yeah. Because after a certain point, once you're out of that HPD phase and you want to go fast, you're going to look for an instructor. You're not looking for instructors that are just going to give you a check ride to give you a pass to go by yourself. Now you're looking for instructors and coaches rather than instructors to help you find that 10 tenths.
Yeah. So Fez, now that you are like the consistent podium guy, do you get people coming up to you asking you to instruct them?
Not yet. Surprisingly, not yet. Sometimes I'll have people ask me, but I think it's just not often.
Yeah. Funny enough, there, one thing I as like an aside, like I made a track guide video of the ridge up here, and I was
love that video.
And it like exploded in popularity somehow, and now consistently every track day that I go to, someone's like, "Oh, you're the guy that made that video. Will you instruct me?" So it's hysterical.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I think for me, I since I'm mainly driving at Good Life. Or like private events, not really HPD events. But not a lot of people know me in Texas either. So Good Life, like everyone knows me. Everyone knows that I'm in Time Attack, and they're all in Time Attack with me. They're all competent drivers. So no, they're not going to ask me for like instructions. But there's times where if I go to an HPD event and someone does know me, they do ask, and then or they like randomly reach out to me on Instagram. They're like, "Hey man, are you going to this event in Chicago or something like that?" And I was like, "No, dude, I live in Texas. I can't do that." But
yeah, we're the crazy ones driving all the way up to the Midwest for events while living in Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, I respect it. So
you respect it?
I respect it. I wish I had the I don't know, tenacity to do that. I feel like living in Seattle is like not a great place though, because it's like California or everything else is 3 days of going direction. Yeah. So,
how long was that drive from Seattle to Minnesota?
That was 2.5 days towing. And
one way.
It's going to be longer back because the wind pushes you that way. So we could tow and enclosed at like 75 and it was okay. But that is not going to work on the way back. I'm pretty sure we're going to be going like
65, 70 maybe.
Yeah.
Is it really that big of a difference with them enclosed?
Yeah, well, what's weird is I think up to about 60, you don't really notice it that much, but as soon as you go past there, it's huge. So, like, to give a reference, like, our truck with the enclosed will get, like, 9.5 to 10 miles to the gallon at 60. If you go 75, you're looking at, like, 7.5.
Jeez.
Wow.
So, that's the drop. So
what truck do you have again?
It's a 2021 Titan.
Is it the diesel or the normal one?
It's the gas, but I mean, honestly, it's comfortable and it's got the 9-speed. So for towing, that's really nice because you can always find the right gear.
Yeah. Yeah. Like with the Expedition, the 10-speed made a huge difference. I love towing with that thing. And then same thing with Fez with his Tundra. He has an 8-speed.
10-speed.
I thought you only saw 8 gears when in tow mode.
Never shifts to, I think the highest I saw was 9th gear. It just doesn't go into 10th because it needs, he's like, I need the torque to be in.
It's on one of the downhill sections.
Yeah, I think the 9th and 10th gear on that truck is pretty useless, I would say. This is they're so close to each other that it doesn't really downshift. It doesn't really go upshift.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, you got those off road tires in the 10, so there's quite a bit of weight in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Expedition is always using boost, basically, when towing.
Same. I'm in boost pretty often.
So I have a question as far as like driver improvement, because I do want to get an AIM, but what I will say is like when I was at Laguna and I had the AIM, the aim wasn't really helping me as much as I thought it would. So basically, like, I found a lot of my time was really just like staring down the guy in front of me, and then wherever there were corners where he clearly was having a gap on me and accelerating, figuring out like what it was that he did, trying to keep up with him and trying to either not necessarily repeat what he did, but do something different about, for me, do something different in the corner that tries to make up the time. So whether that would be break a little bit later, accelerate a little bit earlier out of the corner, or I would sometimes see the car like push out. I'm like, oh, you can push out to that rumble strip and you still have traction to keep moving forward. I don't know, like I treat a lot of my time improvement kind of like what I did in Forza, where I'm just chasing my ghost, except some of these other drivers are my ghost. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the utility of data depends like a ton on the data you have access to and also the kind of driver you are, right? So like, I don't know, maybe using like Fez as an example, like you, I don't know if you exchange data with like other club TR drivers, but if you ever have that, then like you have a ton of opportunity to figure out like, because people are going to be faster in different places and you'll see like the specific areas of opportunity. Or if you're like an aggressive but maybe inconsistent driver, you'll like have the variation in your laps to like see what worked and what didn't. But if it's like just you and you're a more consistent driver, then like data maybe isn't as useful of a tool, because like, what are you really going to compare it to? It's kind of like that like seat time thing, right? If you're just doing the same thing every time, then you look at all the data, like you're not really going to understand the gaps. Like, I know tools have gotten a lot better recently, but if you're just like not super well versed in it, I'm not sure exactly what you're supposed to draw from it. And like, I can say, I, as an anti-pattern, I don't look, I've had an aim for a while, but I don't extensively look at my data, because at least up here, I don't have a bunch of people to compare it to. I look a lot more at like my videos and try to see like what I am actually doing and like debrief sessions, like either in my own head or with other people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think following someone else and their line in the middle of a session is very risky to me.
Oh, yeah. Because I'm like doing their line. If Carl did my line, he'd be in the dirt as well.
Yeah, because like their setup could be different, their brakes could be different, they could maybe break later, but you can't, you know. There could be a lot of different variances. That's why for me, like Carl said, like having aim data is great, but you need other people's data to compare with that have similar builds to yours or similar power or weight ratio or whatever it might be. So you like at Laguna, did you compare with anyone else but yourself? Like, did you compare with Eddie or Luca? Luca was over there too.
No, it was just Ravi and I looking at lap to lap times and seeing like, oh, lap 5 was faster than lap 3. Let's see where the time difference was. Like, oh, you braked a little bit later at turn 4. Try doing that again.
Yeah, that helps a lot. But usually what I do at these events is, the first day, it's just me driving and then doing the best I can, comparing data with myself. And then the night of, I would go and talk to other competitors out there, seeing if I can get some data from them, if we could do some data analysis together, and then the next day to apply it. So if it's Laguna, I would go out and, I don't know, Friday, go out to all the other competitors that you have in street. That gives you a good chance to network too with them and see what they're doing and see what kind of builds they have and why you're so far behind. It could be a bunch of different reasons. They just could have a faster car than you and you can't do anything about that. Right.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. And I guess, like, at least with Time Attack and with Grid Life, whenever we do head out, we're gridded in terms of lap times. And so what I'm trying to see is like, okay, so clearly the person in front of me is faster for a reason. I got to figure out what that reason is. And maybe you're right. Maybe it is just because of the more power. Like, I've been in those situations where I catch them in the corners. I'm like, well, nothing I can do here. And they're just going to freight train past me in the straights. But there are some where I can see that their corners are being taken a little bit differently and I can learn something, assuming they don't go in the dirt. But this is all ammunition to convince Carol to let me buy a name at the end of the year. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about like seeing other drivers and stuff is like really more down to like trying other things. But I think the mistake a lot of people make is like they want to try something, and then to try that thing they like feel it out at like full pace immediately. Like, I'll have like a hard time explaining this, right? But the reason like consistency is so important is if you can like always get to like 100% of the grip soaker of your car, you're like getting the most out of it all the time. But if you go past it, like you screwed up, right? And you have to like drop weight out and correct it. And it's like if you can take a line at like 70% speed, but you can feel like, oh, that didn't feel good. All of a sudden I went from like 70% to like 90% of what I think the car can do, then like you know something about that didn't work. So I feel like a lot of people only think experiments are valid at the limit when there's so much experimentation you can do not at the limit to actually understand what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. Something I've had to learn is like the number boards and the brake zones, like breaking out the 4, okay, that worked. Breaking out the 3, okay, that worked. Let's try breaking out the 2. Oop, that like put me in the dirt. I shouldn't have braked out the 2. I should have braked out the 2.5 or 2.75. Like those are, those brake markers are actually can be pretty significant jumps. And so I need to go, I've learned to like start breaking them up into smaller chunks, honestly, since Laguna. So that way, like, I don't put myself out on the dirt. I'm, instead of being basically going from the tarmac to the rumble strip, and once I hit the rumble strip, I'm like, all right, that's enough. Like, any further, I am going to be in the grass or in the dirt. So, yeah, consistency is, I agree, key, and I'm trying to do better at doing that.
I think something that I learned from DJ as well was that, like, most our tires don't last more than 2 to 3 laps, right? They degrade quite a bit. So you know your 4th, 5th lap isn't going to be the fastest. But if you're not at the point of a skill level where you're putting 100 everything out there right away, you should stay out there. And then that 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th lap that you're doing, that's your experimentation time. Like your tires are already done. You know you're not going to go fast. Now's your time to like, hey, well, I'm in traffic too, whatever it is. Take a different line. Try different braking markers or... just experiment that, and then sometimes that's the period where you might actually end up going faster than your first 2 laps, or now you have data to compare with yourself within that same session. It's like, okay, well, the eighth lap I took this line and I'm like half a second faster because of it, and I can apply that now to my second lap or first second lap.
Yeah, I think also like those laps to keep pushing is so useful for not only the experimentation, but also building the consistency, right? Because what's going to happen is even if you're driving the same, the car is going to change. So you're going to have to adapt to that. And like it builds your own like in, you know, what the car is doing, feeling. Because ultimately, like you said, to be really fast in Time Attack, you have to be ready to go out there every single like lap and it'd be a perfect lap every time. And like that's so hard to do. It's like, yeah, you might be capable of the hero lap, but if you only do that 1 out of 10, you're probably not going to land on the podium, right? Because the chances lines up that the weather's right, the session doesn't get black flagged, like you don't miss the corner, like, you know, there's so many variables.
Yeah, and that's something I applied at Laguna for the first time too, especially with the new system that I have for Time Attack, where you have to go get into podium sprint and then you only have 2 laps to go for it.
Yeah,
like there came a point in my weekend where I stopped trying. I stopped trying to experiment. Where I know I could be consistent at a 39.4, 39.5. That was my consistent mark. Goal was just to be consistent from there on, and hit that same time every time for 2-3 laps in a row. If I could do that, I know my capabilities and I know how fast I can go. And if it's faster than the other person behind me, I'm good. Like I'm gonna stop pushing the car. Try to experiment towards the last qualifying or whatever it might be. And that's why even in a podium sprint, I think I did a 39.6 and a 39.7. Or I did a 39.6 twice, which is that what I was looking for.
Yeah, because your qualifying time was a 39.3 or 39.1. 39.1, because I did a 39.3.
Yeah, 39.1, and then the conditions change, obviously, right? So
yeah,
it's going to vary a little bit.
Carl, what was your fastest time on Laguna again? It was a 37.6?
Yeah, it was like a mid-37. I can't remember exactly. And then I think in the podium sprint, I did like a 38.5. So, you know, have some excuse about having to drive the car home. So,
I mean, the podium sprint...
I got you on podium.
The podium start time was also right after the drifters. It was during like the hottest part of the day. And yeah, it was slower for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... I'm still like salty about that whole thing though. It's so weird. They're like, oh yeah, your times only count if you don't go off. And then like someone went off. They're like, your times still count. I'm like, what is this game?
It's a thing and it still is a thing.
Like, bro, if it was harder, I would have known that would count. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, at that high level, it's all come down to technicalities. It's like the technicality was because he didn't define the limits of the road during the driver's meeting. Mm-hmm. Like, it was basically you could go wherever is like what I got out of it.
Yeah, I even asked them. I was like, hey, what's the track limits? Because I don't want to have another situation on my hand where I go off track. I've done it once. I don't want to do it again. And then they were like, well, we'll find out. And it's like, okay, cool. And then I asked other people, and apparently GLTC was told that within the white line, then you're good. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But then other people were like, no, just go as far as you can, wherever Tarmac is. And I was like, all right, well, which one is it? So after the first two sessions, I just played it safe, because like the last thing I want is not to be DQ'd because of that.
Yep. Yeah. And like the at Laguna, the major, well, there's two areas. Coming onto the front straight, so the very last corner. Yeah. I saw quite a few cars going all the way over.
Turn five. Uphill left-hander.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Turn five.
There was a lot more room on the right side, and I was taking that. And then eventually I was like, well, maybe not, because I don't know if it's out of track limits or not.
Yeah. So like, if you go back into my video, actually, at least on my fastest lap time, my left tires, my inside tires were on the rumble strip, but... Per the rules this year, like that's illegal, and they haven't like disqualified that time. So, yeah, but I'm very happy with the new pavement, because that runoff in turn five was not there previously. Mm. Back when I went to Laguna in 2020, so
I want to go back to Laguna, man. That was one of my favorite tracks to go to.
Yeah, that
the whole week was pretty sick.
I had such low expectations for the track, because like you drive it in a sim and you're like, it's a series of 90 degree corners, like roughly, like how exciting is this going to be besides the corkscrew? And turns out very exciting, because there's so much camber.
There's so much camber, and like it's very quick camber. So like it's very interesting to see the camber, man, turn five, turn six, going up the back straight. Like, there is a half second moment where like it does dip in with enough camber that you could give an extra turn in, and it does help with completing the turn. And like it just, you never notice that in the video game.
Yeah.
There actually is quite a bit of camber and elevation.
That was my favorite corner, because if you got it right, the amount of G forces you feel and how like sucks you in, it was just awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then like if you get it wrong,
and then you're into the wall.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Overall, that was pretty solid.
Because you're also going like 80 or 90 miles an hour through that corner, aren't you?
Yeah. And you're wide open throttle in third or fourth gear, depending on your car. It's a lot of fun. I can't wait for Mid-Ohio. I think of all the tracks I'm looking forward to this year, Mid-Ohio is going to be my favorite. Or at least currently is the one I look forward to the most.
I think Mid-Ohio flows better than Laguna. It's slower speed, but it just flows better.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be excited for that. Road America, I think, will be pretty epic for like the history, but Mid-Ohio, I think, is going to be a pretty fun track just to put laps in.
Yeah. Road America is another one of those tracks where it's just 90 degree turns everywhere. But then they're high speed.
But they are turns. Very fast corners at Road America, which I think is the exciting part.
I'm legit worried about oil, starvation, and the focus on the carousel.
Oh, shit. It's a right-hander, too, right?
It's a right-hander for like 90 miles per hour. It's a 90 mile per hour right-hander or something like that.
Dude, my car starves on oil. I have oil starvation every right-hand turn.
I've never had oil starvation, but just like if it's gonna happen, it's gonna be there, I think.
Yeah.
That type of situation.
Do I pull out of Road America for the reliability of my motor?
Oh, it should be all right.
It's fine. I think with an overfill, it's fine.
Yeah,
because
I'll be good.
I looked at the CAD of it too, and the oil pickup is literally off-centered.
Wow. Real quick, before we start to rumble and mumble about our cards, is there anything else as far as like drive improvement y'all want to bring up? Any like anything we left off the table that would be very beneficial for someone to hear about if they're trying to improve as a driver?
I think, like, let's see, what have we touched on so far? I feel like we've, like, scratched the surface of, like, a few things. I don't know how deep you guys, like, want to get into it, right? Like,
this is just a podcast where we bullshit around, so, yeah, we barely scratched the surface on any topic.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, from what I gathered is not just seat time, but, like, getting good quality seat time and feedback, getting an instructor to provide you that feedback, making sure that instructor is a good instructor. We didn't touch on like sim racing or sim practice and how that could be used as a tool at all, but I use it personally if the track is available in a set of Corsa or Forza just to learn the layout. It's not going to teach you where all the bumps are. It's not going to teach you where the slick spots are. It's not going to teach you how your car will behave at the track or weather conditions, but it does teach you the flow of the track, which I find beneficial, and you're not wasting half a day learning that flow. That's my last piece. That's the only thing I want to add to that. Don't follow someone else's line, otherwise you might go in the dirt with them.
I think one thing we didn't really touch on too much that maybe is like worth adding on to it is like this aggression topic of like how aggressive people drive. I feel like that's like such a big spectrum that has such a big implications on like both learning and going fast. And I don't know, like I've instructed a decent amount of people up here, and like it's interesting to see like there are some people who are way too timid and they're never gonna like go fast because they're not pushing hard, and then there's other people that are on the far other end of the spectrum and just making mistakes constantly, right? And I feel like that's maybe one other thing to think about in terms of driving progression is like, what are you trying to accomplish this session? Because if you're trying to put down a banger lap, like, yeah, you got to push, you got to send it. But if you're trying to learn, that's probably not going to teach you anything to just like go out ham-fisted, right?
Yeah, I completely get that. I feel like that's, to me, when I think about aggression, like that's me really trying to like pull it back with the braking zones and like not overdoing it in the third lap of the day, trying to be more consistent.
It's a really good example because it's even something that I've had to learn like recently, and still like one of my biggest driver weaknesses is like I will keep thinking, oh, to keep building up pace and keep building up speed, like I need to brake deeper, I need to carry more speed on the entry to this corner, right, or whatever it is. But like a lot of times that's not true. It turns out that like sometimes slowing down more in the corner is going to launch you out of the exit harder and net more speed. Yep. Sometimes braking earlier and slower is going to carry like at more average net speed. So like, and like, I don't know, I was driving like a spec E46 last weekend, and like the one car to the track, they're like, yeah, you're really late on the brakes. It seems like you're giving up time. And like, sure enough, like he's up on the brake zone, brake earlier. And like the car just rotates and it's like on that threshold of grip the entire time, instead of like doing this weird oscillation coming off of brakes and like trying to turn. And I think that was
something that my car doesn't like to trail brake. I learned like over at HMP Fez, turn, let's see, your front straight, turn left, turn right, so turn two, basically crossing like over the drag strip. So like what I learned, if I try to follow like your line and try to trail brake, it really, at least at that corner, it really upset the car. So what I learned is that, at least in my driving behavior and my car setup, braking straight and turning in helps a lot better.
I can't trail brake either.
No.
I will say something irritating, maybe, but like I have a hard time believing that's true. And me and another driver, like we're coaching other Nick that runs up here a lot. Like I would say getting to the point where he's getting fast, like going from that like mid-pack to upper mid-pack driving, but he wasn't handling weight transfer right. And I think that's one of the last skills that a lot of drivers develop is like, where's the weight of the car? And like, if you are good at balancing the weight of the car, like you can trail brake pretty much any car unless you set up terribly.
I think that's what I'm getting at. I think it's my setup that's holding me back. And that's something I need to work on.
Yeah, I think pads matter quite a bit too. Like I was running CSG pads for a bit, and that was like a hammer, right? Like you just stomp on it, really high initial bite, and then it fades away, which really it's hard to trailbreak at that. I've tried ER1s that have a better release on them, so it's easier for me to trailbreak. Yeah, the initial bite isn't there, and the car doesn't feel like it's stopping as hard, but I can trailbreak easier to and keep the weight balance better on that on the car with it. Because before too, like when I tried trailbreaking it at the Laguna Corkscrew, I spun out, right? Because the car has no weight in the back already, and then when you stomp on the brakes, it's now it's even less weight in the back. So for the release needs to be perfect for you to be able to kind of not get into the corner and not have all the weight still be in the front, because you're just going to slide otherwise.
Yep. And I think like it's interesting because like I feel like anytime you do something like that, like you put on like CSG pads, like I put on ST43s and a big brake kit on my car, it felt like the same. I went from DTC 60 stock calipers to that, and it was like, I can't even heel toe the car anymore, right? So my initial like impression was very similar, like, oh, this isn't going to work. But it's just like a process of like, wait, what else could I learn to make this work? So
you, with that comment, what I got out of it was that you've been in a situation where you had pads where it felt like a switch, but then you kind of like learn to manage it and still be able to trail break, even though
you have to tune your sensitivity. Like, I don't know, like you guys have mentioned Assetto Corsa, but have you ever played like Competizione, like with a GT3 cars? So when I first played that game, I was like, holy shit, this is impossible. Like everything that I've tried to do in the other game, like doesn't work. Why am I so slow? And like that game in particular probably taught me like trail braking more than anything, because you can't just like stab the brakes, get off it, and expect that the car is going to like behave. Like it will just literally just 180 like instantly if you do that. Especially if you drive some old, like a Porsche or something. Maybe like some, not all the cars do, but you have to have that super gradual, like very precise release to like really get fast. And I think like all of those things that you're inclined to be like, the car is shit, the setup is shit, I should change this, right? Even some of those bad things are worth developing as a driver, because the car is never going to be perfect. So it's kind of like develop your skills for the worst part. So then when everything comes together, you're like completely on it.
Yeah. True.
And that goes to the point as well where, for example, when I initially started, my first reaction when a car wasn't driving the way I wanted to start messing with it. I wanted to change rebound, compression, whatever, or sway bars, and et cetera, to have the car drive the way I wanted it to. Over time, I've realized that's not the way to go. The way to go is to first try to adapt your driving around the car and see if that works. Because if you turn the knobs a little too far, it might make it even worse, right? And then now you're wasting more time, more sessions. So instead, try to adjust your driving to it, and then if it's still like really bad, then turn like two clicks or something to get the car to drive the way you want it to.
Yeah, and I feel like you're definitely at the point now where like you have a sense of the car, and like you kind of know what window you want it in. But I think so many people go to like change things way too early, when it's like you could drive around what you're feeling, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, glad I got you, or sorry, glad we got you on here, Carl. You're not afraid to be like, Nick, you're fucking wrong. Drive better.
I tell you
that. I think I just always want to like try new stuff, you know? Like, it's so easy to just like, you know, take something and just like do it the same way, right? And I am still learning so many things. I feel like I'm still like a pretty shit driver, but like, especially when it comes to like data, but it's interesting to try to learn more.
Yeah. Man, I need to see what I can do to get my brake pressure sensor or brake sensor data into the Cobb AP, or like get that data.
There's an AIM Solo DL for sale if you want that. He's asking $500. I was gonna buy it, but I don't really feel like it right now.
That's pretty tempting. Yeah, because that would I say that I can't really trail brake that well, but at the end of the day, I don't really have any, I literally don't have any data to see what it is that I'm doing wrong. So might hit you up on that, Fez.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I think also going to the topic of anger, a lot of people drive with emotions involved, right? Where they get frustrated and they get really angry, and then they start pushing the car harder and it's not driving good, right? It's just going to drive like shit. You're going to go off. Like that's just how it goes. So how do we put that emotion aside when you get on track is very important. I've seen drivers out at Good Life specifically in my own class where they get so frustrated, they lose everything, right? They go from getting the track record to getting fifth place, right? Like, how does that happen? So I think it's really important to keep your emotions outside of it. Yes, car's going to break. Yes, that there's going to be other people that are going to be faster than you. But when you get on track, trying to keep a level head and just driving consistently is going to net a lot more than you trying to push like 11 tenths to get the car to where you want it to be.
Yeah, so true. I think it's interesting too, because like I feel like it has taken me a very long time, but I've started to get there with like time attack events where I can keep that level head. But now even today, I like hop in like a wheel to wheel race on the sim, and I'm just like sweating bullets, like so just like combination of like aggressive, nervous to screw up, like all of these things, right? But like for me now, whenever I'm like, I don't know about you guys, but like what your hype game is when you know you're getting gritted up and time attack, but I'm just like usually sitting there like caressing the dash of my car like, all right baby, we're gonna do this together.
I don't know, for me, whenever I get up to grid and like get hyped up, I'm not listening to music, I'm just kind of thinking about what I normally try to watch a video and try to find a really good video to go, and that's a really good example that's similar to my pace and my setup and my skills. Mm-hmm. And just try to remember what they did well and at minimum trying to mimic that. And really at the end of the day, I'm just out there to have fun, so I'm always smiling when I'm on track. So like, it was to me when you were talking about like keeping your emotions out and like people getting angry, I was like, I've literally never been on angry. I've been frustrated with someone like not giving me the point buy in HPD sessions, or like kind of taking some funky lines and making it unsafe to pass them in time attack. Mm-hmm. But I've never been mad or frustrated with myself. Hey, that's why I'm slow.
I've definitely driven in anger where you're, and I've fucked up quite a bit too. Like, I'm in Ohio, Gingerman Midwest Festival. I had the second fastest time of the weekend. And then come podium sprint, I overdrove the car and the car was just drifting everywhere. And I got like fourth place. And that I was pissed off for a week. I didn't party afterwards. Like, I didn't go to karaoke afterwards. I just went back to the Airbnb and I was like, I'm out. And I think I had to kind of put that. I was so frustrated that I was thinking about taking a break from competitive driving too. And I was like, this is just ridiculous. But eventually, by the time Laguna came, I was kind of calm and collected again. But it's really important to put that emotion aside. For me, I listen to music. I listen to really chill, calm R&B just to kind of put me in the zone. But I don't have any speakers this year, so I don't know how I'm going to listen to music. I'm kind of worried about that.
AirPods.
And then just take the AirPods out. Where am I going to put them? I don't have cup holders.
They'll just stay in your ear. Just pause the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though, right? Because I feel like, you know, you get that anger to your point, like Fez, probably because like you care a lot, right? Like, you are competitive, you want to win, like you want to do better. And it's like interesting on the flip side to hear Nick just be like, I'm going out there to have fun, right? Yeah. And like probably part is the why maybe he hasn't gotten as angry, but like it's interesting when you talk about like driver development, because I feel like everyone has like, how much, what do you want out of it, right? Are you trying to enjoy it more? Are you trying to go faster? Like, what is it that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah. I think I've said this on a podcast before, but like for me, most of the tracks that I've gone to are first time tracks. So I'm just going out there to lay down my own PB, and wherever that lands me in the competition, that's where it lands me. But for me, I am trying to every single time I go out there do a better lap time, which is really why I haven't like done anything consistently or practiced being consistent. Because I legitimately am trying to do better than the last time I was out there. Because I don't know when the next time I'll be there is. I'm trying to like do the best lap time possible every time I go out there, which puts me two wheels in the dirt sometimes.
I think one interesting point to that, like, is, and I've come to realize this, is once you've done maybe like, I don't know, like even five tracks, I feel like you have enough experience that your skills as a driver are likely going to map pretty well to new tracks. So whether or not, like, you're, you know, like you said, like, pushing at that track really hard or not, you're probably going to be up to speed, like, very, very quickly. Like, even just this year, I went to a new track. I finally went to Pacific, and it's just like, okay, I'm pretty much up to pace on, like, my fifth lap, because I just know how cars work at this point to be, like, up to, like, 90% of the lap time pace, right?
Yeah. Well, what about the next 10%? Like, when do you push for that?
I guess, like, it depends. Yeah. I mean, it depends if it's, like, competitive event or not, right? Like, and what the event format is. I think, like, I wouldn't push, like, harder each session, but that was, like, first event of the year, so I also have to wear the, like, I'm an idiot, let me start over, because I haven't driven in, like, 5 months, because the season here is not year-round.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I don't think I hold back that much. I went back, like, 2 weeks later and drove a Specky 46 and, like, was a second off the owner's record. So I'm like, okay, on my first session. So I'm like, clearly I'm not holding back very much, even, like, right off the gate.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll leave it at this, like, for myself, is that I always try and improve. But I don't get mad on where I place. It's like the same thing for school. Like, I did well enough in school, but I never, like, cared to get valedictorian. I was like, as long as I'm in top 10%, then I'm solid in my mind. And so,
yeah,
I think that's cool down to, like, my personality. See what?
It starts getting very philosophical very quickly.
That's what podcasts are for. That's why these are fun. That's why I enjoy them.
Guys, I feel like you've been all over the map on that one.
I'm a very competitive person in general. So for me, having fun comes secondary. I have fun when I'm winning. Or if I'm, like, podiuming, that's when I'm having
fun. To me, like, that's the bonus. That's the icing to me.
Yeah, I think it was less stressful for me when my car wasn't competitive. Because at that point, I'm having fun, and I don't care about getting podium because I know my car cannot do it. So I'm just like, I had more fun then. Now my car can get first place every single time, and it's like putting that pressure on me, not just for myself, but sponsors or other people's expectations, which, you know, you shouldn't care about people's expectations, but it does kind of catch up to you. It becomes way more stressful, and I'm towing out really far distances, spending a lot of money to go to these events. I better fucking come top three. That's, like, my expectations for myself. Otherwise, like, why am I spending this money to do that? Like, if I just wanted to have fun, I would do, like, two events a year and I'm done. You know, why am I doing five or six events?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it gets really hard. I feel like when you start to get to that level, right, like, where you're at, and, like, I would say, even I'm not there on, like, the competitive scene where you're at, where you're driving consistently far away to, you know, collect podiums and stuff. But it's interesting because I think you get to this next question of, like, where do I go next, right? Like, do I keep doing this, right, which is very expensive, takes a ton of effort, right, you know, takes you away from a lot of other things in life, like, especially once you, you know, get married and other stuff and all these other, like, competing priorities come into place, and you're like, how much do I care about this thing that I'm doing, and where is it going to go? Because I think once you've gone from the bottom to the top in one series, right, like you have with Club TR, and like I think I've done it with like On Grid here, you kind of ask yourself, like, what's next? Do I like just go up again and restart this process again? Do I keep doing what I am doing? I don't know, that's where I'm at right now, where I'm struggling a lot.
We should save that for another podcast topic. Title that one be like, what's next?
Yeah.
Go down that
very, very short one for me. I think,
why is that?
I think in general, dude, I'm at the point where I think I need a break for my own mental and financial sake. A year-long break where I'm not focused on just competing. Like, I still want to go out to Gear Life events. Like I said, like, if I was doing it for fun, I would just do like one or two events and then call it a day. And then eventually I would like to build another car for another class, or maybe build the GR86 to a point where I can go compete in Street GT with Boost or whatever it might be. Or it's not Street GT, Street Mod. You know, or just buy like an M M3, M4, or G80 that I can just go have fun in Street GT, drive it to the track, and drive it back home in comfort.
Cayman GT4.
Or a Cayman
GT4. No, I mean, like, I'm so grateful I have that car, because, like, this year in particular, like, I'm just using that car to just go out and have fun, because I know it will work, and it's quick enough to, like, have a good time, right?
Yep.
No offense, Honda Fit owners, but it's different because corners are not corners at, like, my track in a Honda Fit, because I've driven one there. So, you know, it's just a very different feeling. So, but it's weird, right? Like, when you want that, like, time off, but then you know that, like, then you're not developing as a driver. So.
And I think I want to focus on myself and financially as well, right? It's hard to focus on your financial health goals and physical goals when you're so involved in motorsports. You have to give one or the other up, because you're putting hours, like a ton of hours into this.
Yep. Well, and that's where it kills me right now, right? Because the whole reason I ever even like wanted to go to school and get a job and all this stuff was to like do car shit. Like, that was always my motivator. And then I made it to a point, you know, maybe like 2-3 years ago, where I could like sustain that at like the level that the S2000 competes at.
Mm-hmm.
And like, now I could go to that next level, but that's like a huge chunk of money that's like life changing, right? And it's like, is that the direction that I want my life to change in, to do the same thing I'm doing, but at the next level for like 10 times more money?
Right. Yeah. It's a legit question you need to ask yourself. But I'm with you there, Carl. Going to school, like, pretty big motivator was buying that car that I always wanted and just, like, going out to different tracks.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It gets weird. Like, I'm, like, I have the debate with myself every day about if I should upgrade my GT4 to a GT3. But then I'm like, why? Would I really have more fun with that versus the 4?
Must be nice to have that dilemma.
I mean, it comes with sacrifices, right?
Yeah.
Just like, yeah. I mean, not to say we don't all work really hard, but, you know, there's sacrifices for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, yeah. 11 o'clock. I think we made a podcast, y'all. Any last final words?
In conclusion, to start Time Attack, make sure you're safe and responsible. Have a good instructor or coach to get you there. And then don't be angry. What else? See, time alone won't get you where you need to be. You need data. You need data from good people. You need to be in the right environment.
And yep.
That's pretty much it.
Yep. And if anyone wants to ask you some follow-up questions, Carl, where can they find you on the socials?
At Mr. Conflicted is still my Instagram.
Very nice. I'll link it in the description as well. So if anyone wants to find you, they can also click down there. Yeah. Thank you, Carl, so much for coming on here.
Thanks, Carl.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Definitely not me.
A blast.
Sweet. Cool. All right. We're going to sign out. Got any last words, Fez?
No.
No? All right. It is close to bedtime for this old fucker, myself. Anyways, thank you all for joining on here. Hit us up on the DMs, and we will see you at the next episode. And Fez will definitely be at Harris Hill at this weekend, so we'll talk about that. I'm going to hold him to it. All right. Night, y'all. Later.